And now, your hosts for Life from the Pulpits, here's Nick Perez.
That's right, and welcome to the new era of eloquence and exposition. This is Live from the Pulpit, the fastest half-hour podcast in the West, live, local, on location at Davis Park Church of Christ in Modesto, California, deep in the heart of the Central Valley. We're offering up news and views you can use on Scripture and society with a little help from my friends. Greetings, welcome to the program. I'm your host, by the way, the voice of the valley, Nick Perez. Greetings, welcome to the program. Glad you tuned in. Sponsor this half hour is Davis Park Church of Christ, located at 901 West Rumble Road in Modesto, California. Davis Park Church of Christ is composed of people who have received the mercy of God, people who are focused upon the mission of God, and people who engage in ministry for God. Davis Park Church of Christ meets every Lord's Day, that's Sunday, for Bible study at 9:30 a.m. and morning worship at 10:45 a.m. We also meet every Wednesday for midweek Bible study at 7 p.m. We hope you stop by and visit us sometime. She's served by our preaching minister, yours truly, as well as our outreach minister, Buddy Grave. Go online and visit DavisParkChurchModesto.com for more information. Davis Park Church of Christ, making a difference one person at a time. I've had the privilege of sitting in the high school youth group here at church the last couple of weeks. And if that's not something you've done, I want to encourage you to do it, to get to know the young people of the congregation where you serve. It's been an interesting study in generations. The youth group is comprised of those who are on the tail end of what is commonly called the millennial generation. And so these are folks that are part of my generation. Again, they're just the tail end. I'm kind of towards the front end of that spectrum. But there's, again, it depends on who you ask, but essentially there's about a 19 or 20-year window there for the millennial generation, approximately 1980 to 2000, maybe 81 to 2001. Again, just depends on who you ask. So these are folks that are part of my generation, but they're a very different group than what I grew up with. Part of that could be just the difference in groups of kids, the technology boom that these kids have been a part of as well. They've never known life without technology, smartphones and cell phones and things like that. Whereas I didn't get a cell phone, right? Your parents, I didn't get cable till I was 12. You know, I was for me, I didn't get a cell phone till I was in high school. So to sit in here, and we've been discussing, I haven't been leading it, I've just been sitting and listening, but what has been discussed is why the millennial generation, why their peer group is leaving the church, and what can the church do to bridge the gap between the church and the youth group. Between the church and their generation. How can the church do that? And where we'll end up is, what can they do? And what's interesting is, as we've discussed this, they've been talking about stuff that they want to do. It'll be interesting to see how this kind of manifests in the days ahead. I hope it's not just a whole bunch of revving of the engine, but you're not going to go anywhere. But they're a creative bunch. They have questions, some that were a bit disconcerting to me, that they don't know some of the stuff. And I guess looking back, admittedly, I didn't really know some of these things either. I remember studying with a fellow who I was either a senior in high school or freshman in college, but I was studying with a guy who believed in the miraculous ability to speak in tongues, languages of angels. And I wasn't real sure what to do with that. And so I went and asked someone who was older, the preacher, and he pointed me in the right direction. It was an interesting discussion about how they view leadership. I don't want to say that they're suspect of authority figures. I think they respect authority. However, they're reticent to the fact that they don't really know the leadership. And as part of the leadership team, I think the onus certainly falls on us as leaders to take the reins of that, to take charge. But they themselves admitted they want to know who their leaders are, and maybe they should be more proactive. So it was encouraging. Also, again, some of the questions were a little perturbing. I don't understand why you don't know some of this stuff, other than we haven't been teaching it. But at the same time, it was encouraging because they desire to know. They were asking good questions. And, we're going to have to postpone the long answer. I gave a short answer to one of the questions they had. And, but again, it was overall encouraging to hear a generation that desires to be more involved with the church. And so, you know, the thing about generations is... That's always going to be one of the challenges in the church, is to reach across the aisle, reach across and down through the pathway of years to the next generation and invest in them. Sometimes we don't always do the best job about that. And so, you know, how we do that is critical. And so, you know, one of the things that I've encouraged where I've been a minister on staff is intergenerational participation, getting the older generation linked up with the younger generation, trying to stress the importance of those kinds of relationships, building mentor relationships, the older generation mentoring the younger generation, which is a biblical concept, read Titus chapter 2. And so one way I've done that is through a ministry called Prayer Pals, and people had issues with the name because some other group used it, and it was like, you guys... It may say maybe the same name, but it's not the same thing. It's a different thing. And just giving an older person the name of one of the young people in the congregation and saying, I want you to pray with them. If you want to invest more, take them to lunch, take them to putt-putt mini golf, you know, something like that, that's fine. And that's encouraged. But you don't have to. Just pray for these people. Call them on the phone. You can do that. Pick up the phone and call them and say, hey, I'm thinking about you. I'm praying for you. If you see them at worship service, maybe just a brief word of prayer with them right there in the foyer. That's good too. But really just helping the older generation know who the younger generation is and investing in them, telling them you're valuable, God loves you, and as a Christian, I love you as well. You know, this sort of stuff, it bleeds into culture. And maybe a better way of saying that is culture reflects what's going on with the generations and how they feel. And some of the struggles that happen in intergenerational relationships. The new trailer for the Star Wars movie that's coming out in December dropped this week. I don't know if you saw it, but if you're a Star Wars geek, guilty, then it was great. I was listening to someone talk about the newest Star Wars movie that'll be released here in the middle of December. they were asking somebody who was close to the film, how was this new Star Wars movie going to reflect present culture and the present time? That's what movies do, is they typically are a reflection upon culture and work to communicate a certain message. And it was interesting because this particular person said that the main bad guy and main good guy, they are going to come to a place where they don't want to be all bad or all good, or they come to understand their place as not all bad or not all good. Which I thought was interesting, because I can understand not wanting to be all bad, right? Not wanting to be Darth Vader. But not wanting to be all good. And this, it's a reflection upon millennials. That's where a lot of millennials are. A lot of millennials, my generation, they are the reluctant leaders. And I began to reflect upon, why is it that my generation is so reluctant to lead? We're supposed to be a hero, a generation of heroes and civics, kind of like the greatest generation that won World War II. But we're reluctant to do that. And I was reflecting upon this, and I thought, well, why was it that the greatest generation did what they had to do in order to defeat evil? See, that's the thing then, was there was good and evil, and the bad guy was the bad guy, and the good guy was the good guy. And there was no attempt to conflate the two. Why was it that the hero generation did that? And it could be that, for one, they didn't have, like we do today, they didn't have a generation that was older that was calling them down. The next generation that came along was a silent generation. Then came the boomers. Why is it that the boomers did so well? And I guess someone could argue about, well, did they really do well? Well, here's the thing. They did what they did and did what they wanted to do because they had that silent generation ahead of them, and they had a doting generation before that, it would seem, that saw the potential of all that they could be and pressed them forward. And so you had this doting generation, you had the silent generation. And I think that's why you saw these particular age demographics take off like they did. So fast forward to the millennials, my generation. Why is it that we're reluctant? And I believe there's a couple of, for one, those of the greatest generation, right? Those that are still around are pretty much nostalgic, pining for the former days and the former ways. The next generation, they're not nostalgic. They're more of a know-it-all. Been there, done that, and so you need to listen to me. Now, I know that's painting with a broad brush. Not everyone's like that. But I think that contributes in large part to why so many millennials are reluctant to lead. So what do we do, right? That's the question. All right, fine. If that's the case, what do we need? And to try and come along and guilt or scare the older generation, the boomers, you know, if you don't pass the baton to the millennials, you know, especially in my context with the church, they're not going to be around. They're going to leave the church. Some have tried those scare tactics, those guilt tactics. They don't work. For one reason or another, that people don't want to hear it. If you try to approach the millennial group, although we know, right, or at least we think we know better or best, we're still reluctant. And so if a older, wiser person comes along, well, chances are we don't want to listen. And I think that's what's going to happen in Star Wars, by the way. You're going to have an older man, I guess. I don't know what Snoke is. Who's going to come along and say, fulfill your destiny. And whoever he says that to, I don't know who he says it to, but whoever he says it to, doesn't want to do that. And so then you also have a little conversation there about determinism and free will, right? Fulfill your destiny. That's what the older generation is saying. Just fulfill your, do what you're supposed to do. Whereas you have the younger generation, you have an older gentleman who comes along, who has experience, knows what needs to be done, telling, it would seem, one of the protagonists what needs to happen. The Jedi must end. You see that in the trailer with Luke Skywalker, right? The Jedi must end. And I wonder how the younger generation is going to take that. In the latest trailer that they released, he says, this isn't going to go the way you think it's going to go. And so here he is. He's the older, he's the wiser, he's the experienced one, trying to communicate to the next generation. And again, when the older generation tries to do that to the younger generation who thinks they know better. And so what do we do, right? I mean, that's the question. We've tried talking this out. And that's the thing. Have we really? There is a discipline to silence that a lot of people are uncomfortable with. Don't believe me. Just go and be silent with someone. What's the matter? Is there something wrong? Well, why aren't you talking? We live in a culture, in a society of noise, and we think that we just have to babble inanely at any given moment about anything. And so the likelihood is that we've talked about this, but we've talked past each other. And the older generation didn't want to hear it. The younger generation didn't want to hear it. We haven't sat and truly listened in silence to one another. Well, how can we both be silent? Well, good question. A very good question. A lot of people don't want to practice the discipline of silence. They're uncomfortable with silence, except for maybe the silent generation, right? But I think that's what needs to happen, is the older generation needs to swallow their pride and understand, yes, you are the older generation. Yes, you've got the experience, but you don't. This isn't fulfill your destiny stuff, okay? And the younger generation needs to humble themselves as well, swallow their pride, and sit down and say, I don't know everything. And tell me more about why the Jedi must end. Today in church history, John Brown, who was a Scottish minister and theologian, known for his exegesis as a preacher, died today in 1858. I really enjoy John Brown's works. I have his complete Discourses on 1 Peter, I think is what it's called. Three volume set. Think about it. Peter is five chapters. This guy wrote three fat volumes on it. Prolific. Expository Discourses on 1 Peter. That's what it's called. Prolific. Well, he was a Scottish man. He was born in Whitburn, Linlithgowshire. Studied at Glasgow University. But he was ordained a minister in 1806. Labored for 16 years in Lanarkshire. He had a controversy with Robert Owen, the socialist. Here's what's interesting. He was appointed as one of the professors in the Theological Hall of the Secession Church in 1835, and he was the first in Scotland to use this exegetical method of exposition of Scripture, to go verse by verse through the text in the pulpit, and as a professor, he would illustrate that method, and then that would allow him to extend its use. He'd teach other ministers how to use it, show them how it's done, and then they would go out and do it all. He was the first one to do that in Scotland. It was because of him that the principle of interpretation, which is known as the analogy of faith, was abandoned largely. It was because of his expository style. He did have some controversies with the church, but and that was mostly because he was charged by those who held to the doctrine of limited atonement. He was charged with heresy, so because of his discussion of the atonement. But John Brown, no slouch. There were other works that he's done, exposition of Discourses and Sayings of the Lord, Exposition of the Lord's Intercessory Prayer, Expository Discourses on Galatians, Analytical Exposition of the Epistle of Romans. Prolific guy. I enjoy his work. Very deep thinker. And it was on this day, 159 years ago, that he died.
And now it's time for the question of the day. Question of the day.
What do you believe Jesus looked like? What do you believe Jesus looked like? Very good question. But a question which there is precious little in the Bible about. Believe it or not, none of the gospel writers give us any description of Jesus. His physical form, what his eye color was, or hair color, or any of that stuff. It's not in the Gospels, not in Acts, not in any of the epistles. The closest we get is in the book of Revelation, in the New Testament at least, where highly figurative language is used in order to describe the glorified Jesus. The hairs of his head were white, like white wool, like snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire, his feet like burnished bronze refined in a furnace. His right hand, he had seven stars. Out of his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword. His face was like the sun, shining in full strength. But that's, again, the glorified Christ, and it's highly figurative language to describe his glory. This is what it was like. So, again, that's the closest you get in the New Testament. What about when Jesus was on earth? Again, nothing in the New Testament describes what Jesus looked like physically. However, in prophecy, in the Old Testament, in the book of Isaiah, chapter 53, there is a very brief description that's given to us prophetically concerning what Jesus looked like. Isaiah 53 and verse 2 says, "He grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him." no form or majesty that we should look at him, no beauty that we should desire him. Jesus had all of the resources of heaven, all of the resources that go along with being the second person of the Godhead at his disposal in order to create his physical, fleshly body. He could have made himself the most attractive man who ever walked the planet. Think Brad Pitt from the movie Troy. Jesus could have made himself look even better than that. All right. Think Michelangelo's David, chiseled out of marble. Jesus could have made himself even more beautiful than that. He could have made himself the most majestic-looking male who ever lived, but instead he chose the weak, the foolish, and the ugly things in this world. Our culture values beauty. We love beautiful things. We love majestic things. And we devalue the ugly things. We turn away from that which is ugly. And so it's no wonder that Isaiah 53 goes on and says, right after that, verse 3, he was despised and rejected by men. He was one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised and we esteemed him not. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Just as our culture values beautiful things and devalues ugly things, the same seems to have been true in Jesus' day as well. People continued to reject and despise the ugly. He had no beauty, no form, no majesty that we should desire him. What do I believe Jesus looked like? Probably just another average, ordinary man. No form, no majesty, no beauty. Perhaps even ugly. It could be that Isaiah here is prophetically looking forward in time to when Jesus was scourged and beaten and his flesh torn into, and that's when ugly things were happening to him. It's possible, I suppose. But I think through the eye of prophecy, Isaiah is looking down the pipeline and he sees Jesus face to face, and there's no beauty. Not in the physical sense. Make no mistake. There was no deceit in his mouth. Jesus was beautiful spiritually. But if we're talking about what he looked like physically, I think Isaiah is the closest you're going to get. I'm out of time. Feel free to leave a comment on the website. Always like to hear what you have to say. Search Facebook, Life from the Pulpit, like the Facebook page, and you'll get updates when I go live with a podcast, update the blog, or post a new video on YouTube. Speaking of YouTube, search YouTube, Life from the Pulpit. Many of the Question of the Day segments are there for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study. Now on iTunes, search the iTunes store, Live from the Pulpit. Download all the episodes to your particular iDevice, and you'll never be more than a click away from an episode of the podcast. Follow me on Twitter, @InPulpit, at the letter N, as in Nick Pulpit, P-U-L-P-I-T. Same handle on Instagram. Be sure and stop by the Life from the Pulpit blog, L-I-F-E from the pulpit.wordpress.com. All of my commentary there on Luke, James, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, John, Philippians, Ephesians, some stuff on the Psalms there as well, all for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study. Check out Davis Park Church of Christ website, davisparkchurchmodesto.com, davisparkchurchmodesto.com for more information. Plenty of sermon audio there as well. And as always, brethren, grace be with you all. Thanks for listening.